Some things shouldn't be transparent, like stop signs. But what you pay for should always be clear, like Hiller's True Transparency Pricing, always clearly itemized and never any hidden fees. Because you have the right to know what you're paying for. For more information, visit happyhiller.com/true-transparency-pricing. Happy you'll be, or the service is free.
Call the Happy Face Truck today.
John Feinstein joins us now. I appreciate him on the Monday Night Football Week, rearranging the schedule a bit for us. John, thank you. How are you?
Jonathan, no problem at all. I'm just fine, a little disappointed. Chad may have mentioned to you guys, I was supposed to be on Morning Joe this morning promoting the book, but they bumped it. I mean, I hope it'll air tomorrow, but with these shows, you don't know. And I've had these experiences before. One time I was doing the Today Show, or supposedly doing the Today Show, and I was sitting in the green room, and I was like 5 minutes away from going on the air. And what happened, because these shows so rarely do sports, is sometimes a producer will sit there in the control room and say, "Oh, you know, we don't need to do this sports thing. Well, we can delay it. We can do it another time." And somebody came in and said to me, I was sitting there with the PR person from my publisher, we really had to bump you. I really apologize." And it was just a kid, an intern. He was a messenger. Mm-hmm. And I said, "What for? What happened?" And he kind of stumbles around and says, "Iraq," which is sort of a catch-all at that point. And my publicist says, points at the TV set and says, "There's a guy on the screen juggling now." So, clearly, he wasn't juggling while discussing Iraq.
What'd you get bumped for today?
I have no idea. Still trying to find out.
I recorded it, John, and I was fast-forwarding through it. And it got to the very end. And they had the same two or three panelists they kept going back to about every 30 minutes. And for that last 20-minute block, I'm thinking, okay, they're gonna have John's interview now.
Yeah.
And they go back to those same three panelists to talk about something else that's going on.
Well, I had turned it on at like 8:45 Eastern time because I know sports is always going to be the last block, and they get a bunch of commercials, and then they're running past 8:50, and it was a long interview. It was like 10 minutes long. It was really good. It gets to be like 8:53, and they're just coming back from commercial, and they had some guy on who was a director of some new news service, and I'm like, well, guess I got bumped. And it's very frustrating when that happens, because obviously when you're on shows like that, you reach people you don't normally reach for a sports book, and people who are sitting there going, "Oh, I need a Christmas present for my husband, boyfriend, son, daughter, whatever," and all of a sudden it's not on. So honestly, I hope that it's on tomorrow or Friday before it becomes too dated. And again, it's the kind of thing that's out of your control.
And we're talking
Meanwhile,
about
the reviews have at least been very good.
Yeah,
and
we're talking about John Feinstein's latest book, Quarterback: Inside the Most Important Position in the National Football League, which you can buy right now. In fact, I'm on Amazon right now, where you can buy it very easily. John, I'm curious, when you're promoting a book like this, you've had the privilege of writing a lot of books because your books have done well. So you get to keep writing books when that happens.
Right.
How stressful is it when you're watching the business side of a book? Because you read interviews with actors, some completely get away and they don't want to know how their movie's doing in the box office. Others just sit by their phone and they monitor everything the entire weekend to see how things are going. What side of that are you on?
I'm kind of in the middle, Chad. I you know, if I said I just don't pay any attention to it, you know, or like people will say, I don't read reviews or I don't read what people write about me, they're lying. I mean, I've had people tell me how much that they never read my stuff and then start quoting from the last thing I wrote. So I'd be lying if I said I didn't read reviews. I'd be lying if I said I don't pay attention. But I try to compartmentalize and not obsess about it, not check, you know, on sales every 2 or 3 hours, which you can do now with computers. And because there's nothing I can do about it. I mean, other than the stuff I'm doing to promote the book, I try to do everything I can in that area, but the rest of it's out of my control. And do I worry about it? Absolutely, I worry about it. The publishing industry isn't what it used to be. Nobody's getting paid as much, including guys like John Grisham, as they used to get paid, and that certainly includes me. And I do worry about sales, and I want my publisher, you said it exactly right, Chad, I want my publisher to want me to do another book. So I do worry about it, but I try not to obsess about it.
Do you walk through books? I imagine somebody like you walks through bookstores pretty regularly still. I'm curious about placement, because people are walking through bookstores in the next month probably more than any time in the calendar year.
You're 100% right about that.
And placement has got to be at a premium in terms of getting the book somewhere where I'm more likely to pick it up, page through it, and consider it as a gift.
Yeah.
How does your publisher work that? How cutthroat is that? And what do you think when you walk in? Are you crossing your fingers like, please let it be in a decent spot?
Or? Yes. And it's very cutthroat. In fact, publishers literally pay for positioning now. That didn't used to be the case. But nowadays, if you want a book, unless it's, you know, Barack Obama's book or some major celebrity's book or John Grisham, who's always going to get good placement because he's John Grisham. But unless you're one of those guys, your publisher pays for placement. They pay Barnes & Noble or certain independent stores for placement at the front of the store. And if you don't pay for it, you're going to be back, you know, somewhere in the sports section, in my case. And you hope that – and one of the other things that happens is – if you don't pay for placement, the store is apt to order fewer copies because not as many people are going to see it, and thus not as many people are going to buy it. And I've always been very reliant on word of mouth on my books, that beyond that, whatever publicity I might get, a Morning Joe is a big hit. Last week I was on the NewsHour. That was a big hit. That helped sales. You could see it. But I've always been very reliant on word of mouth. You know, obviously when Season on the Brink came out, nobody had heard of me, and my publisher expected the book to sell a few thousand copies in Indiana. And then people started talking about the book that I had the kind of access no outsider had ever had before. And boom, the next thing you know, it's number one on the bestseller list. And a lot of my books start not that quickly out of the gate, and then pick up momentum because of word of mouth. And, you know, obviously with Christmas coming up, as you said, Paul, I'm hoping that's what will happen with this book.
Since we're in the process and we like process, I'm going to keep going a little bit more. I've seen lesser known people whose you know, first book is, you know, in a quiet aisle somewhere.
Right.
And maybe they're on a trip to Seattle and they sneak in there to see it and they go ahead and pull it off the shelf and sign it.
You don't have to, you know, do it on your own. Usually if you go to a manager in a bookstore and say, my name's John Feinstein and you have my book Quarterback here, would you like me to sign stock? They'll jump at that. Because I don't completely understand why somebody would be excited about a book that says Best Wishes John Feinstein or Best Wishes Any Author without it being personalized. But a lot of people do. A lot of people, you know, like before this book came out, Barnes & Noble sent me 5,000 what are called tip-ins, where I just wrote Best Wishes John Feinstein, and they stick them in books. So that, and then they advertise, you know, John autographed copies of John Feinstein's new book are in these Barnes & Noble stores. So I don't know why it's a big deal, but it is for booksellers a big deal to have autographed copies. So they're always willing to let you do it. Now, what I did do, Paul, when Season on the Brink first came out, before the publicity started to hit and before the word of mouth started to hit, it was a big deal to me just to see a book I'd written in any bookstore. And I walked into a few local bookstores here in the D.C. area, and there was my book back on the sports, you know, in the sports section, and it might be in the bottom row or something. And I looked around, made sure nobody was looking, and took it and gave it better placement, you know, put it on the top shelf. And I called my agent. And I said, geez, I feel terrible about doing that. I mean, and she said, don't feel bad. I go into bookstores, find authors who I don't like, and turn their books around so people can't see the title. So after that, I didn't feel so guilty.
Cutthroat. How long did it take you to sign the 5,000?
Oh, God. I did it over a period of probably 7 to 8 days. I would just sit down at some point during the day and try to sign, you know, 200 or 300 to get it done. Your hand gets sore fairly quickly.
Mike Keith, Keith Bullock, and you talk Titans football. Titans Tonight, Thursdays at 6 on 104.5 The Zone.
Midday 180 served up by Wendy's. John Feinstein with us.
So, John, I think Michigan had a pretty good season with two losses. Of course, it ended badly in a loss to Ohio State. But I'm seeing a lot of heat on John Harbaugh from Michigan people.
Jim Harbaugh.
Yeah.
There might be some Michigan heat who are down on John, too.
That's true. Yeah. Some Ravens fans that are also Michigan fans.
Right.
Is it fair, the heat that's on Jim Harbaugh from Michigan fans, when you look at what's gone on in those games against Ohio State?
You know, it's fair and it isn't fair, Chad. Like you said, they've won 10 games, 3 out of Jim Harbaugh's 4 years. And he was brought back to, wake up the echoes, so to speak, and has done a good deal of that, and was starting from pretty far behind, given where Ohio State's program has been for most of the 21st century. Whether under Jim Tressel or now under Urban Meyer. But on the other hand, the reason he's being paid the big bucks is to beat Ohio State, to beat Notre Dame now that they're playing them again, now that Notre Dame has deigned to play them again, to beat Michigan State, which, they did do this year. You mentioned John Cooper syndrome. I think that's a very good analogy, because John Cooper's record at Ohio State was absolutely sterling. But I think he was 2-11-1 against Michigan. And that's what ultimately got him fired. And I do remember John Cooper had one of the great lines of all time, back before they had overtime in college football. Ohio State won the Rose Bowl 1 year. And he was handed the trophy, and he said, "I want to thank our fans who are with us win or tie." And I thought that pretty much summed up most sports fans, actually. Some people have tweeted at me because of what you're talking about, Chad. Should Jim Harbaugh be fired? I think his overall record is something like 38-13 now at Michigan. But I'll tell you what, if they lose at home next year to Ohio State again, there will be a lot of pressure on him.
Let's stick with the Harbaugh family. A lot of talk right now about John Harbaugh and his future with the Ravens. If it doesn't work out with the Ravens, a lot of people speculating that he could possibly land a top college job if it comes open. Do you think John Harbaugh would be a successful college coach?
I do. I have a feeling he'll land an NFL job if he's not brought back in Baltimore. I think John Harbaugh is very highly respected. They haven't been as good the last 4 years as they were his first 7, when they went to the playoffs 6 times and won a Super Bowl. Some of that's because of injury. Some of that's because, frankly, Ozzie Newsome, who is being retired as general manager at the end of this year, as great as he was for many, many years, has made some real drafting mistakes in the last few years, although I think Lamar Jackson's going to turn out to be sort of his last great contribution to the Ravens. But I think John will be a head coach somewhere next year. If it's not in Baltimore, it'll be in the NFL or it'll be on the college level. I happen to believe that in most cases, if you're a really good coach, you're a really good coach. I know people have examples, particularly in basketball, where college coaches go to the NBA and fail. A lot of the times that's because they're given very bad NBA teams. They take over very bad NBA teams. But I think John Harbaugh, I know John Harbaugh well. I don't know Jim well, but I know John well. And I think John will be a successful coach wherever he is next year.
John, Reuben Foster arrested at the team hotel in Tampa Bay on Saturday, waived on Monday by San Francisco, and then claimed by Washington this week.
Yep.
My question is a different approach to it, because it's certainly not a good look for Washington and the message they're sending. If fans believe in collusion through the owners and through the league, why would the league not collude to leave Reuben Foster alone?
Well, it's a good question, but the way I would put it is that a message probably was, you would think the 49ers cutting him would be enough of a message that this is not a guy you want to mess around with. But what the league has done, as you know, Jonathan, is they've now put him on the commissioner's exempt list, which means he almost certainly won't play this season. And I'm sure Washington knew that would happen when they picked him up, and they're thinking he's a young guy and, we'll rehab him off the field during this season and he could be a starter for us next season. And Dan Snyder and Bruce Allen, those two football geniuses, decided it was a good gamble, and they really don't care about the guy's image off the field as long as he can play, and he's a talented player. That's always been their approach. They've been consistent with that. They really don't care about who people are as long as they feel they're going to perform for them. And my guess is Roger Goodell is not very happy about this happening, and that's why, what was it, a couple hours before he put him on the commissioner's exempt list yesterday.
Everyone was able to watch the match between Tiger and Phil for free as it ended up. Verizon was the last outlet to refund the purchase price. All of this because Bleacher Report couldn't figure out the paywall online, and some of the people were able to watch
allegedly.
For free. Allegedly, that's right. So is it true that no one made money off of this except for the two athletes?
Probably. That's probably the case. I mean, I don't know how the corporate deals were structured, but certainly there was a big loss of money because of apparently, you know, there not that many people were buying it in the first place. And maybe that's why there was this sudden problem that allowed people to watch for free. But Phil Mickelson made a lot of money. Tiger Woods made less money. I may have missed this, and I'm not being sarcastic, but has Phil Mickelson, who made apparently $9.6 million before it was all said and done, announced any contribution to charity since last Friday?
I don't know.
I know their side bets were all going to charity that they made on each hole, but I don't know that he's announced anything with that.
Well, and that amount of money was limited by the PGA Tour. But I haven't heard it. I saw something that before the match, they both said they were going to give some of the money to their foundations, which doesn't exactly impress me. But I haven't seen anything where Phil Mickelson has announced he's going to give $5 million or something to, you know, victims of the California wildfires or something like Aaron Rodgers did. But the good news about what happened, Jonathan, about the whole thing, is it was such a debacle, I don't think we'll have to deal with another one of them.
Well, and it's this is what I found fascinating about the whole experiment. And I actually think they might do it again if they get the right two guys. But, John, it got better when they stopped talking to each other. I thought the beginning of it, going back and watching it where they're talking back and forth, that part was awkward. When it seemed like it got a little bit more serious in the last nine holes, That's the only parts to me that were compelling. I don't know what that says about Tiger Woods and Phil Mickelson and if someone else could make that work the whole time. But to me, it became more compelling television when they stopped the banter back and forth.
Well, if they wanted to make it entertaining, the two guys they should get are Paul Goidos and Patrick Burke, who nobody's ever heard of, but who are the two funniest guys I ever knew in golf. Put them out there for 18 holes. They're both pretty good players. Not famous, but pretty good players. And that might be entertaining. But from everything I heard, including I saw tweets and stuff from guys who are, you know, big supporters of this concept and who are big Tiger Woods guys or Phil Mickelson guys or both, the golf was pretty desultory. And, you know, I'm sure the golf course was set up easy to try to create a lot of birdies, but it wasn't very good golf. As you said, Chad, it wasn't entertaining. Everything I heard was that the so-called banter / trash talk was very stilted. It wasn't real. None of it was real. The competition wasn't real. And I don't think golf or any other sport needs this kind of thing.
I feel like when you try to do something different in broadcasting, it either works or it's terrible. There's no middle ground there. Dan Dockich, to me, is a different type broadcaster. I'm watching him on the Michigan State-Louisville call last night, and I'm reminded just how much it works with Dan Dockich, how honest he is, the way he talks about the players, the coaches, the game. He clearly loves college basketball, but the way he talks about it is different from every other television analyst out there. I want more Dan Dockich at games. I don't know how you feel about it, John, but I think he does great work.
Well, I am very biased. Dan and I are close friends. We spent a lot of time together. He was a graduate assistant coach when I was doing Season on the Brink. We were both single. We actually brilliantly came up with an idea to diet together by going to an all-you-can-eat Chinese lunch buffet every day. We thought somehow we'd lose weight doing that. So we were good friends. Neither one of us very bright, but good friends. But I say that as a disclaimer. Before I answer the question, that Dan's a good friend. I think he's terrific. And I think he's terrific, Chad, because of what you said, that he's honest. So that if he is praising someone, you take it seriously. It's not like Dick Vitale, who I like very much personally. But Dick praises everybody. So his praise doesn't mean anything. But when Dan praises somebody, it's meaningful because people know he's willing to criticize. And the other reason he's so good is, frankly, is, you know, bad diets aside, he's very, very bright. And he does his homework. He's always prepared. The coaches respect him, so they tell him stuff. And I agree, Chet. I think he's great. And the better he does, the happier I am because he is a friend.
John Feinstein joins us every week here on the show. John, thank you as always, and we'll catch up next week.
My pleasure, guys. I hope by the time we talk next week, Morning Joe will have gotten around to airing that segment.
Us too.
Take care.
Thank you, John. John Feinstein, normally Mondays with us at 12:15 here on the Midday 180.